Welcome to Vase, a podcast about weird stuff. I'm Pete C. Hine, and joining me as always is my old friend and co-host. He's dialing... Ugh. Fuck me. Start again.
I'm leaving that bit in.
Yeah. That's for the Outtakes album. Welcome to Vase, a podcast about weird stuff. I'm Pete C. Hine, and joining me as always is my old friend and co-host. He's dialing in today directly from his Glasgow office, where he's been busy creating a world of magical wonder, where his orange-faced, green-haired acolytes create illicit substances with cut-priced lab equipment, where the local youth gather to collect their rations of three magical beans and a tangy fluorescent elixir, and where he haunts the walls of this dreamlike centre of industry only to emerge periodically from a transdimensional mirror to admire his own handiwork. That's right, the unknown is his middle name. It's Mr. Stephen the Unknown Buckley.
Wow, that was very on topic. That was like very of the time. Not on topic, sorry. What's the phrase?
Topical.
Topical. Yeah, topical. Yeah. Sort of right bleeding edge of...
Yeah, I'm glad you noticed.
Memehood. It's, that was nice. Thank you for that. Do you know, listener, I actually played Willy Wonka once in a school play. It was the second to last year of primary school, so like around 9, 10 years old. The school staged a play of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and I was chosen to play Willy Wonka. And my parents still have a video of it, so I might digitize that someday. And then the year after, and I'm going somewhere with this story, don't worry. The year after, there was like a float, like, and this was my last year of primary school. It was like a May Day parade kind of float, and I was all set to play Wonka for that too. I had Wonka experience. I'd learnt, you know, a lot of lines to play Wonka. Yeah,
reprising the role.
And I still had the outfit. I still had the, you know, so I was all set to play. And then I got fucking salmonella, didn't I? And I was in hospital for 2 weeks and I couldn't play Wonka. But...
There's a lesson in there.
Well, no, but well, yeah, there is actually, yeah. That guy whose barbecue I went to. But anyway, when I was in hospital with salmonella, that was when I first saw Queen's Greatest Flicks, the video of... all the Queen songs and realised that I wanted to be in a band, and then met Peter C. Hine here, and that was how our friendship formed. Also, that hospital trip was where I first watched Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
So in many ways, it was your destiny to miss that second Wonka opportunity.
Exactly. And yeah. Close Encounters of the Third Kind is... I love that film. It's a film about UFOs, which brings us...
to today's guest.
Smoothly...
Very true. I like that segue. Yeah. You're getting good at this podcasting thing.
Oh.
I'm proud.
I should have prepped it now.
So our guest tonight is one of the most interesting and unique and balanced voices in the seemingly endless hellscape that has become the modern UFO discourse, as much as I hate to use that expression. His podcast, Our Strange Skies, UFOs Throughout History, is currently on hiatus, but will soon be back. It's one of the few UFO-centered podcasts that I can both listen to continually without getting bored and continually agree with. Their work as one half of the creative force behind the webcomic strip Welcome UFO People, together with Todd Purse, is a weird and dreamy retelling of classic UFO tales, which has me checking their Instagram feed daily. That and the volume of books which they recommend and the breadth of perspectives that those books cover is a constant inspiration. It's Mr. Rob Christofferson.
Dear God, that intro. Like, I think that is the best intro I've ever received. And, you know, after seeing all of that, because, like, you know, I'll haunt TikTok for a while. After seeing all of that Willy Wonka experience stuff on there, I've never wanted to go to Glasgow, like, and any more than now. Like, I am sorry that I missed it.
It's like, I've not been to Glasgow for a few years, and look what's happening when I'm not there. It's like, I need to get back up there.
I went quite recently, and that's probably why it happened.
You got that Willy Wonka role going again.
I was like Richard Doughty, but Willy Wonka, sort of seeding myself into the community and, like, you know, kind of spreading out ideas of Wonka related. Yeah.
So we haven't really done an episode on UFOs, or certainly not from a believer's perspective. We've talked about them with Mark Pilkington. We've talked about them with Emily Louise. Which is weird, really, that we would start with two kind of fairly hardcore skeptics on the whole topic. And I think in some ways, I don't know about you, Buckley, but I've kind of been avoiding it, the talking about UFOs, certainly in a way which... would relate or could relate to the current climate of the UFO discourse, which obviously I hate to call it that, but there is this huge thing, particularly on social media at the moment, about disclosure, about, you know, all like how the congressional hearings have gone and that kind of thing. But we wanted to get Rob here onto the show, I think, as our first guest who's an actual expert in the UFOs, because I think that, Rob, your voice really does stand out amongst the noise that's sort of surrounding this topic at the moment. There's a few things that I admire about your show and the way that you tackle the subject. I mean, I trust the things that you're saying. You know, this seems well researched. It seems that you're actually doing the research, that you're educating yourself in these topics. You seem to have integrity and you seem to think critically about this stuff. The research is deep, and for the most part, it's fairly sort of non-judgmental, but you do have a fearless tendency to go after the grifters, which I always admire. But you do it all with a sort of great sense of humour and a willingness to laugh at the subject matter, which often calls to be laughed at. And there's nothing worse than people taking it too seriously. And your show's had a load of our favourites on it as well. So you've had Willow Truman, Steph Quick, A.P. Strange, Greg Newkirk, Emily Louise, Sequoia Kennedy and John Tenney, just to name just a few. So what made you want to start this podcast and what made you want to start this journey?
I had a UFO sighting at work in 2015. And what really stood out about it is like it felt very personal. It didn't just feel like some random event that happened. Because on that particular day, so for anybody that doesn't know, I work in a nursing home. I do the laundry for, it's a decent sized nursing home, about 60 people, 60 residents. And on that particular day, I was like, no, I'm not going out. Cause a friend came down and asked me to go out on a break. And I'm like, no, I can't. He's like, I'll help you, you know, catch you up and stuff. Just come on out. I was like, all right. So we go out. And he lights up a cigarette and like a minute or two later, look up and there's this giant egg in the sky. Like,
whoa,
flying at the relatively low altitude too. And it's like, what am I looking at here? Because like, you know, when you think of UFO, you know, you think, you know, classic saucer shape, maybe a cigar, some triangle looking thing. How do people react when you say, it's a giant egg? I saw this giant egg, because there's no other way to describe it. It had an off-white color to it. It was about the size of like a VW bug. It was, you know, fairly substantial. And while I was looking at it, I told my buddy, I was like, hey, take a look at this thing. And he kind of looks at it and not really interested in it. And the funny thing is that we talked about UFOs all the time. It was something that we were deeply interested in. And he's just like looking up at us like, eh, it is what it is. And I'm like, it's a flying egg. What are you doing? And I just watched this thing. It was maybe in view for less than 5 minutes, but it was moving slow, probably less than 1,000 feet in the air. And it's kind of moving parallel to where we're standing, like really, really slow. And it gets to right about where we're standing, at least from my view. And it stops midair, turns 90 degrees, and it moves away from us just like really, really, really slowly. And it stuck with me. It like boggled my mind because it felt like a right place, right time kind of scenario. Yeah. But like, at the same time, it felt like a fated, you know, fated event. This is, you go outside, you see this in a moment where you don't think that, in a moment where you're refusing, absolutely refusing to just like go out and do this. So it stuck with me. And then I started to get my hands on, you know, book after book. Like, the thing about having an interest in UFOs, being a UFO researcher, it's really a book trade. Like, that's the easiest way to put it, is like, and I think the best equivalent, if you want it in like a fictional form, is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. If you've ever read that book or seen that series, it's absolutely wonderful. But it's literally about, you know, a society of magicians who, like, love to collect books but don't do magic. So
right, yeah.
I've read Piranesi, but not that one. It kind of intimidated me a bit because it's so big, but like, I really want to read it. I've got it. It's there, ready to be read. Same.
I've got a copy of it, but it is a massive book, isn't it?
It is. It's like 800 pages plus long, but it's absolutely brilliant. But that's the thing about, you know, all of this stuff is like, it really is like a book market. I mean, that's literally what I do most of the time is like buy books, read them, and kind of pull my own stuff out of it. But back in 2015, I just started getting my hands on books. I think the first book I got my hands on was Intruders by Bud Hopkins. And like, I'm someone who's very critical of that man. So like, it's very interesting that that's my introduction. My introduction to it really was that book and the History Channel series Hangar One, which is, it's an interesting series. It's not particularly great, but like you get, there's like a lot of really foundational cases that they featured on that series. And after that, I just started really diving into it. And it seemed like 2017 was the year that paranormal podcasts really started to like take off. Like I had a bunch of friends that were doing them, and every now and then I'd be like, recommending them cases and stuff and be like, hey, check this out, maybe it'd be interesting to feature on an episode. Because like, and this is a hot take, you know, say what you will, but like podcasts these days, they cover the same damn cases over and over and over and over again, and it drives me nuts. Not to say that those cases aren't worth covering, but there's other stuff out there, folks. There's other stuff. But like I can't hear the Mothman tale recounted anymore. I've just heard it so many times at this point. It's just, it's not interesting. It's like, oh, did you hear so-and-so did this? It's like, everybody's done it. It's just, they're showing up to the party. But, one thing that I just really prided myself on is like finding weird cases that nobody talked about. In one case that I recommended to some friends, was this case called the Mojave Desert case, in which this married couple basically goes out camping and they can't get in on a particular campground. So they go and find this like really kind of remote area. And in their camper, they just like settle down for the night and they experience what I like to call like the alien invasion model of alien abduction, in which it's just like aliens coming at them like crazy and stuff like that. The Mojave incident, it was an interesting one. And a couple of my friends did it the same week on their podcast. I was like, all right, maybe you should space it out, guys. But like, you know, I was like, that's cool. I dig that, you know, these stories can be featured. So eventually I was just like, why not do it myself? My dad was in radio for like 25 years. So I was like, it feels like a natural extension of what radio is. So gave it a crack at it and did. I've done like 175 episodes at this point, and maybe it's 175 too many. I'm not sure, but it's been an interesting ride ever since.
Yeah, and yeah, I do think that you do bring a lot of these lesser known cases to the forefront in your podcast, and you do sound very natural behind the microphone as well. I think I've got loads of questions about this experience you had about this giant egg, because Todd Mudden case at the Pennines near to where me and Buckley live, wasn't there an appearance there of a flying egg in the
don't know, I can't remember now,
egg shaped craft or something.
I think it was fairly kind of oblong egg shaped kind of situation here. That case is strange in so many levels, because how do you go and get abducted by a Hebrew gentleman, and like that's—I think that's the weirdest aspect. Is like you getting abducted by a Jewish dude? Is that what you're telling me right now?
Yeah, because that's the one with the whole Ziggy Adamski.
Yeah,
thing, yeah, yeah, yeah. Because when we had Greenfield on, I tried to sort of see if I could get some like weird shit out of him about like the fact that he's called Ziggy Adamski, and then there was George Adamski, and like yeah, it seems. Yeah.
Adamski's not Stardust as well.
Yeah, you know, like Adamski's not a particularly common name in the north of England, rural north of England, and like, but he didn't seem interested in picking up that particular thread. So I was like, okay,
It's cool because that whole flap that happened is like about an hour away from where we live. You know, like actually we're going over there on Saturday. Yeah, it's like there's and because so much of this. These UFO cases happen in America. It's nice to have one from the north of England that we can sort of have a look at and poke at and stuff. But when you saw this egg in the sky, you said that your friend just kind of wasn't interested in it. And that's an interesting detail as well.
I believe was the phrase he used. Yeah.
But like, I was listening actually when I was doing some research for this episode, I was re-listening to the Greg Newkirk episode that you did about the big-eared aliens, and one of the things that you talk about there is the apathy ray, you know. And weirdly, AP Strange, that we talked to a few weeks ago, was saying loads of people encounter these weird things in their life and then just immediately forget them because it doesn't fit into their worldview, you know. It's almost like they develop like an immunity to the weirdness. And what was that the case with your friend, you think, or what was going on there? Could he see it?
Oh, he definitely saw it, but yeah, it's just like a general uninterest in what it was, and even to the level I was at, like, he had his phone on him. I don't know why I didn't tell him, hey, take your phone out, take a picture of this thing, like, take a video. Like, it's very weird, like. And it could have a terrestrial explanation. I'm not saying that it couldn't. It could definitely be like a kind of like a drug drone, but it didn't look like a drug drone because there was no visible kind of means of propulsion. It didn't make a sound. It was just completely encased. There was no windows, at least from, you know, my vantage point. I don't know about the other side because I only saw like, you know, one, like two sides of this thing, you know, the like a profile view and then the back of it. And yeah, it's just, I don't know really how to explain the apathy part because it's as if to go on in normal life, you kind of need to know about these things, but they can't really like take over your life because I've had other weird experiences, including one. I love dropping these weird things because like, I don't even know how to, really describe them most of the time. But, there was one morning and a lot of my encounters seem to be surrounded by me going to work or being at work. It's very strange, but there was one morning, probably about like 4:30 in the morning, walking to work, and I see what you could best describe as a lizard person. Like I don't know how to describe it any other way, but it was hunched over in this one person's yard, and I got to within maybe 25, 30 feet of this thing, and it stands up, looks at me for maybe about 5 seconds, and then takes off into this one person's yard. And I'm standing there. I'm kind of dumbfounded for a couple of minutes, and then I'm like, I've got to go to work. What the hell? You've had like one of the most like strangest experiences of your life, and you still have the 9-to-5 job to deal with.
Yeah. It reminds me of the sort of thing that you see on like a fantasy film where the children see the monsters or the creatures or whatever, and the parents just deny that it's there and just like, yeah, come on. Do you remember that book? I don't know if they had it in the US. It was called Not Now, Bernard.
No.
And it was like a child's book, and it was And basically this kid like keeps saying to his parents, like, there's a monster. There's a monster here. And his parents are just like busy getting on with adult stuff. And they're just like, not now, Bernard. Not now, Bernard. Just, you know. And then eventually the monster eats him. Like, just devours
him. So much for happy endings.
Yeah. But it's like, it's that whole thing, isn't it, where almost like adulthood kind of sucks it out of you. Almost like that we've said before about like kind of it takes away that kind of imagination and that kind of wonder. And I guess like that's the kind of first thing I thought about with your friend, like not wanting to acknowledge it, because it's like, you know, it sort of doesn't fit into the sort of practical means of kind of getting things done, you know. It's almost like and then it also makes me think of the kind of the Colin Wilson idea of Faculty X, and the idea of, you know, sort of that we've kind of almost evolved to not be able to see certain things and perceive certain things because they're not conducive to like, you know, kind of...
They're not necessary to our survival.
Yeah, to survival, yeah. And certainly not survival in like the sort of 21st century kind of hyper-capitalist society that we live in.
If there's ever been a greater indictment of capitalism, it's the fact that we can't see the aliens and all that stuff anymore. Like, you know, down with it.
What did your lizard man look like?
It looked like it really did look like a short person, maybe 4.5-5 feet tall, scaly, had a tail coming kind of off the back and up a little bit. But the most startling thing about this creature, being whatever you want to call it, was the face. The face looked very human. Like, really? The eyes, like, because when you think of like, and I don't want to invoke this man's name, but like a David Icke kind of lizard person, the eyes are huge and like they got this third eye in the middle that they can, you know, force you to do whatever they want with. It wasn't like that at all. Had a very, like, very human looking eyes, very kind of modest facial features, and that kind of stare really just reminded me of another person. Like, I'm just looking at another person just here and now.
It's a weird parallel to a friend of the show, Rick Bennett, who saw a dogman on his way to work in a sort of similar thing, you know, like he saw this thing running, you know, and he knew it wasn't a dog. He knew it was something else. And then... you know, then of course, like, these things then disappear, and then you've got to just carry on with your life, you know, go to work, you know, do whatever you need to do, you know, eat your three meals and go to bed, you know. It's just a very weird feeling, isn't it? Because these things shape our understanding of the world, but at the same time, there is this necessity to almost compartmentalize them, to say, oh, yeah, well, okay, well, that was the lizard man. But, you know, I've got to pay my rent, sort of thing. And I think that's the weird, like, tension in modern life, isn't it? Because, like Buckley was saying, so much of, like, the modern capitalist society is just to keep us in a routine of, you know, get up, do your 9-to-5, make your money, pay your rent, repeat. And then there's all this other stuff out there, which I think is kind of some of the things that you... well, kind of woken up to, I guess, by the giant egg.
Yeah, like, it makes you wonder, why can't Mothman do anything about capitalism? Like, what's stopping Mothman from just, like, you know, overhauling the government at this point?
Yeah, Mothman for president. I reckon Mothman could have, if we as a race had made a better film out of Mothman, then perhaps he could have done something about it, you know, because there would have been like more Mothman merchandise, and then maybe he could have like kind of infiltrated the mainstream sort of subconscious a bit more. But as it stands, like, because the film was so poor, it didn't really take off as a concept as much as we would like.
He needs a new PR guy, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. because I don't think anybody was doing Mothman any favors with this Chicago O'Hare stuff. You know, it's just, it's kind of a little PR, but seriously, a good public relations person can do a lot for Mothman, can do a lot for like Frogman, the Squonk, whoever, you want this to relate to. I think it comes down to the fact that cryptids and, strange beings and stuff really just need better PR. Once they do, they're unstoppable.
Sasquatch is doing okay, whoever's representing him.
But look at his film. I mean, Harry and the Hendersons, amazing film.
Oh, yeah.
Pictures of him in the paper all the time.
Yeah. Harry and the Hendersons, we watched it a couple of years ago, me and my wife, and I'd not seen it since I was a child. I was like, this is still good.
Isn't it?
It's still a great film. Like, cried at the end as well when he goes back to, spoiler alert, when he goes back to his family, like his actual Bigfoot family, and then looks back at them and stuff, like, it's great. It's a really good film.
It's interesting because last week we were talking about The Crow, and you said The Crow really hadn't stood up against the test of time.
No.
But then Bigfoot and the Hendersons has. Interesting.
Yeah. I'm going to say the wrestler Sting did more for The Crow than anybody did, because like that was his gimmick, it's basically, I'm going to be The Crow, but the wrestling version of it. I had a friend who wrote a book, a novel. It's called Between. Her name is Megan Whitmer, and it's like a novel that involves cryptids and stuff like that. And one of my favorite lines in it was she called Bigfoot an attention whore. And I mean, that makes a lot of sense because Bigfoot definitely, I think, seeks more attention from anybody. Just like shows up everywhere. You see this tall hulking figure, even coming out of UFOs at times. It's absolutely ridiculous. Just like coming for it all. And you got these battles between certain cryptids and the amount of attention that they get. It's always between Bigfoot. You got the Nessie, Champ, Ogopogo kind of triad there that I like to call it. It's a pretty solid union there. And then it just seems like, you got your aliens and then everybody else is just like climbing and clawing for scraps. It just comes down to a PR problem.
you get the odd little gem that stands out though. Like, I'm a big fan of Jeff the Mongoose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so like odd. I remember reading about that in the book Haim was in about the Osborne Book of Ghosts it was in, and like everything else in that book was like a standard ghost, was a, because Jeff was in the Book of Ghosts, I believe, wasn't it?
I think he was.
He wasn't in the Book of Monsters. Now everything else in the ghost book was like what you'd think of as a ghost, it'd be a spooky white sheet or a skeleton or something like that, but Jeff the Mongoose was just a little animal like that could talk, and it's like, what is this? This is odd. And it sort of seemed a bit silly, but then out of every story in that book, that's the one that I remember the most vividly because it was the most like weird. So I think Jeff's one of them guys in terms of PR who his PR person was like, right, let's strike out and do something that no one else is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be brave. He was a what's the word for it? Like a maverick, wasn't he?
Mm. Oh, yeah. It was a bit of a one-hit wonder, though.
Having said that, he stood the test of time. We're still talking about Jeff today. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's what you get for being a talking mongoose, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff the Talking Mongoose is the safety dance of strange beings.
Yeah, that's exactly,
you're definitely on our wavelength.
Yeah. So before you saw this giant egg, did you have a general interest in UFOs or the unexplained or anything, or was that ignited by your strange sighting?
I had done paranormal investigations for a while before that. I was so into the show Ghost Hunters back in like the early 2000s, mid 2000s. And I remember got inspired to contact a psychic in 2007, 2008, somewhere around there. Back in the during that time when like shows like Paranormal State, Psychic Kids, these were like, you know, pretty big shows in the paranormal world at the time. And I reached out to one of the psychics that was on the show because she did personal readings. And it was like an hour long phone call. Which, you know, things have come a long way. You know, you could do things over Zoom now, and now, you know, before then I'm like making long distance calls. It's ridiculous. But, I asked her, like, am I always going to have this interest in paranormal stuff? And she's like, oh yeah, but it's going to be UFOs mostly. And I'm like, that was weird at the time. Cause I'm like, that's not really where my interest is. And then, you know, fast forward 7 years later and it's like UFO Central. That's like my bread and butter. That's where I that's where, you know, everything kind of revolves around these days. UFOs, humanoids, because they're always connected, the two of them.
You do seem to read so much, do so much research into it, you know, always on your social media, there's different books being posted. I saw you post one today. You know, you seem to be like just doing tons and tons of reading around the subject. How do you stop yourself from getting bored, or how do you keep an interest in it with all this stuff? Because you must be coming across the same stories over and over again, just like in the podcast world, the books recount the same stories so often. How do you, like, how are you selective about what you're absorbing so that you don't get bored?
I'll usually focus around a certain time period or a certain topic within the UFO phenomenon itself, and that usually will carry my interest for a certain period of time. Like, I get really fascinated with certain types of flaps, because I think flaps can tell you just kind of like a lot while leaving a lot of questions on the table, because you're stuck with the idea of why did UFOs care about like France, Italy, and Brazil and Venezuela in 1954. Why those two things? Because they're two totally separate areas, you know, like you're like continents away, thousands of miles. And, it's like, well, what's the connecting factor here? And there is no connecting factor. And in looking at these things, you see how distinct they are. So in, you know, 1954 in France, people are talking about mostly seeing these strange beings wearing what they call diving suits. So, you know, they're wearing these, like, I tend to wonder if they did go scuba diving every now and then, because, like, it seemed like the outfits were made for it, but always standing near these UFOs, sometimes they'd, like, flash these lights at people that would prevent them from going forward, which is in and of itself another fascinating aspect of this, is, like, how do they have this ability to, you know, people say paralyzed, but I don't think that's a correct term. I think immobilized is like the easier way to say it. It's like, how are they able to do that? You have that going on in France. You have in Italy, a lot of even stranger cases. There's the Rosalotti case from 54 in Italy, in which, you know, this woman goes out to and I think the most interesting aspect of this particular case is that she's gathering flowers and such for an altar to Pellegrina Madonna at the time. So she's doing that, and she encounters this I think the easiest way to describe this UFO is like the old school kind of like candle snuffers that look kind of like metal cones that you would put on them. Two of those joined together, a pair of like legs sticking out, holding this, weird cylindrical object on the ground. And there are two essentially gnome like figures that are dressed, they've got capes on, which I appreciate. Humanoid with a cape. Like, I get it. I totally get it.
If you're going to visit the Earth, then please, please, like, do it with some style.
Yeah, exactly. And they're wearing, like, what I would describe as kind of the old school, like American football helmets, just like that kind of like leather strap, you know, down. And they steal her flowers from her, return two of them, and they go into their UFO and they retrieve this black box. And the thing is, she thinks they're going to take a picture of her, so she runs away.
Because that bit freaks her out.
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah. Like the, you know, UFO, weird gnome-looking creatures, they're going to take my picture. Like, what is going on here?
But, I mean, that story is, like, a good example of one that, I mean, 100 years earlier would have just been a fairy story.
Yeah.
It has so many. The idea of taking something and giving something back.
And the unusual outfits.
Yeah, yes. And the very strange shape. Rather than being like a craft, it's an assembly of shapes, you know, like cones put together and stuff, which kind of reminds me now of this stuff that Graves was talking about with the spheres with the black squares inside them. And that sort of weird shapes. But I'm just going to kind of go for it whilst we're on this subject. Like, what do you think this stuff is? You know, like, is that, so are these things that Graves saw the same as what that woman saw with the flowers? And are they part of the same phenomenon, or are they something different? Is there kind of this one UFO phenomenon, or is it a conglomeration of loads of different things that are going on?
That's the, like, bajillion-dollar question at the heart of all of this is, like, what is it that people are seeing? So, you know, we have all these categories that people throw things into. So it's like extraterrestrials, interdimensional. You had Mac Tony's with the crypto-terrestrials, which is fun. It's a fun theory. I enjoy it, even though he didn't believe it so much himself. But it's a fun... if anybody listening to this has never picked up the crypto-terrestrials by Mac Tony's, pick it up. It's absolutely fun. There's a story in there of a woman who sold a pack of cigarettes to an alien. I mean, how can you like go wrong with a book like that? But when you kind of... narrow things down and really start to look at this, it doesn't seem to me like any of those fit. I don't think it's any of those things. I in the last few years, I've really started to look outside these theories because I just don't think that they fit. I don't think that as much as extraterrestrials, I don't think extraterrestrials would come around to mess with us as much as interdimensional beings would or anything like that, because when you read these stories, these interactions or even like non-interactions, which seems to be more prevalent than interactions, which I think is one thing that this phenomenon is mislabeled as. So in the 80s, when Whitley Strieber came onto the scene, when Bud Hopkins came onto the scene, David Jacobs, these three individuals, I love with them all, but they kind of changed the nature of this phenomenon. And that's not to say that like abductions weren't a thing before that. There were people, lots of people that claimed abductions, but there were a lot of people that had encounters that were of a non-contact nature. So in 1966, there was a great publication released by the Flying Saucer Review, which is, I think, like the best UFO journal that there ever was. And if you go and you look through the kind of digitized collection that is available online, there are a lot of great names that are doing articles there. And in this one publication called The Humanoids, it was the first special edition of Flying Saucer Review specifically devoted to this topic. Before then, nobody really wanted to talk about the aliens themselves or the fact that these objects landed because they felt it took away from the credibility that the only thing worthy of looking at is what are these things flying in the sky? So they devote an issue to all of this, and they lay out this kind of history. And in one essay, a guy that doesn't get enough credit, because I think Jacques Vallée kind of supplanted him, is a researcher named Amy Michel. He was a French researcher. He's kind of Vallée's mentor in many ways, because he came on the scene before Vallée did, wrote two books beforehand. And he wrote this essay about non-contact. And he lays out all these points in going against like the traditional idea of non-contact, which is, why don't they land on the White House lawn and things like that? Why don't they land? And he sets down the idea. It's like the idea of them, they're not here for contact. They're here for whatever they're here to do. And that in and of itself is interesting, because if you do read through those accounts in many of these cases, they're not trying to make contact with people. They're trying to keep people back, trying to do whatever they want to do and take off. So the idea of non-contact to me just kind of, it doesn't fit with anything else to me that we normally like run through and debate on what these things could be. So I started really listening to David Perkins, who, rest his soul, he died last year, but he was a proponent of the Gaia theory. You know, the idea that, like, and he took it a step further than the original proponent to the theory was, in that, like, the Earth as a living, in essence, being in its own right, kind of has special abilities to do things that we wouldn't normally think it could do. At least that's how, you know, I take it. So to me, these encounters, what they mean to me and how I interpret them is that they set a person on a path. They, whether that's, you know, a life path or a just like a mission in life, because up until I think like really Ryan Sprague and Mike Clellan started to cover the stuff that they started to cover, nobody had really bothered to ask, except for like the abductees, how did this affect people's lives? So in essence, I think what this phenomenon is that it's a life purpose given to people from the Earth itself. That's the easiest way that I can boil it down, which is when you tell people that, you look crazy as hell. And it's so fun to see the looks that people have on their faces, because it's just like, what are you even talking about? It's like, yeah, you've never even thought about it, have you? But like, like every other explanation just does not seem to fit for me.
You're in the right place, idea. Though. With, yeah, that idea is great. And it's interesting, because the last few guests we've had on, I've asked them directly the question, what is the connection between this phenomenon and the human consciousness? You know, why, you know, what is the connection between people and this? If people disappeared, would this phenomenon continue? And that kind of thing. And that neatly ties into that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there is that direct connection between the experience and the experiencer. And a meaningful one at that, from what you're saying. Do you think that people are therefore connected to the Earth, in that the Earth is giving these messages to people in order that people will do certain things to benefit the Earth, or to bring around some sort of harmony or order or a specific goal or anything like that?
If you look at it, and the messages that people receive a lot of the time, certainly seems so. It certainly seems to, the messages always seem to be of benefit to the Earth itself. Hey, stop messing with nukes. Hey, stop, you know, doing this, doing that. And in one of the best examples of that is the aerial school landing from Zimbabwe.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In which, yeah, you know, a lot of kids said, I saw these beings. They told me a message. They said, we need to stop destroying the Earth. And I mean, even if you look at the contactees and be like, well, they're not very believable, the message most of the time is the same, which is, hey, stop messing up your planet. Now, I don't trust, like, it just kind of, in the contactee sense, seems to be built into most of what that movement was trying to portray. There are some people that believe that's a legitimate movement. Like, I've read certain works saying, like, well, this is the form that the aliens chose, and, like, they wanted to test us and stuff like that. And I was like, I don't think so, but you can't overlook the fact that that message is there. It's like, hey, man, what are you doing with all these nukes? Why, you need to cut that stuff out. So, yeah, it does seem to be messages beneficial to the Earth itself most of the time. But I think it's also deeper than that, in that even if it doesn't affect that person to do those kind of things, and I'm not saying that they don't, I think it has enough of a profound effect that it sets them on their journey, whether that, you know, there are people that went and became, you know, kind of like actors and pastors and, you know, things like that. Like, it forces you to look at life as something that is more than the 9-to-5 stuff that you do every day. Mm-hmm. It forces you to step outside your comfort zone and look at things in a broader perspective that I think is easy to get misconstrued.
So it's an initiation, essentially.
Yeah, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, you know, in my theory, it's not like the Earth is explaining itself, you know, because
like, if it could, then we wouldn't know, we wouldn't mm-hmm. understand it anyway. If it, you know, right. How do we understand a planet?
Right.
You know, we mm-hmm. could only understand it almost through something kind of subconscious and dream logic-y.
Like, yeah, yeah. Yes. I love this idea because it yeah. almost feels like people are an organ or an emanation of mm. the consciousness of the Earth.
Yeah.
And that this is almost, to use like a term, although not strictly in the way that he used it, that Valet used, like a control mechanism, mm-hmm. you know, to, in a way, you know, this... It's interesting because Joseph Matheny, when he was on, talked about the collective consciousness, you know, yeah. and how that connects people, which is also interesting because the egg that you saw as well is very Ong's
hat. Yeah.
But that almost feels like we are connected by this, you know, we are one thing, you know, like a one consciousness, which is being, in with your theory, kind of like slightly manipulated, kind of pushed and pulled a little bit by the Earth itself and mm-hmm. this greater consciousness, which we are just on the very edge of. I just think it's such a fascinating idea.
Mentioned Whitley Strieber earlier. There was sort of quite a bit of environmental stuff in his in what he was told. I seem to remember because I didn't realise that that film, The Day After Tomorrow, was actually based on a Strieber. But I obviously you mentioned that you're not a fan of Strieber. Me and Hein both tried to listen to the audiobook of Communion, and it's just like so harrowing, upsetting. Depressing, like it's mm-hmm. just horrible. But like I made it near enough all the way through. But I'm reading a book at the moment by Jason Horsley called Prisoner of Infinity. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so for the listener, like it's basically like looking at Whitley Strieber's experiences and then like sort of breaking it down into like his own kind of theory of what happened. And he's talking about kind of it's, I mean, I'm only sort of a fraction of the way through, maybe like 30 pages in, but he's talking about like the sort of how he the author Horsley had like a what sounds like some kind of horrific experience, which kind of fractured his personality. And he's talking about all the stuff that he saw that was very, very, very similar to what Strieber saw, you know, the little men in blue cloaks and things like that. And like all these various kind of medical sort of, like experiments being done on him that are very like intrusive and things like that. And it's all kind of, like I say, I'm nowhere near the end of the book yet, so I don't know kind of what the conclusion is, but, what are your thoughts on Strieber then? What is it about him? Do you just think he's a fraud, or do you think something happened to him and he's screening that memory with something else? Or what are your thoughts on him?
I think communion and why so many people related to it is because it is such a personal experience, like in grueling detail of what a man, you know, went through and the experiences that he had. And while I'm not someone to automatically say, oh, he didn't experience any of that, like I'm not someone who likes to rob people of their experiences unless they're being absolute grifters, which I think to a certain extent Strieber is, but I think Communion is kind of that touchstone book that scares the pants off of people. Like, it was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, NPR did a list of the 100 best horror novels, and they put that book on there. Even though it's not a horror novel, it reads very much like it is, to a certain point.
When I'm reading the Horsley book, and I actually, in preparation for today, re-listened to your episodes about Strieber as well.
God bless you, because those episodes.
No, it was good. I enjoyed them, and like, but I guess one of the reasons I wanted to ask was because I could tell you weren't a fan of his, but you kind of kept your opinion quite guarded. Mm. You didn't go too kind of deep. But one of the things that struck me was that Strieber's experiences, they're not horror and they're not sci-fi. They're more like dream logic. They're more akin, if they could be compared to anything, they're far more similar to something out of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Or like the dream sequences in The Leftovers or something like that. They're far more like dream logic. They're not, they're horrible, but they're not horror. They're not horror books. They're not, they haven't got the, I'm not a writer, so I don't know what, but there's certain beats and certain structure and certain tropes that make a horror horror. And likewise with sci-fi. And I don't feel like Communion is either of them. It feels like it's from a dream, in a way which very few creative people are able to sort of successfully do. Obviously, David Lynch is the best example of someone who creates with dream logic in a way that is almost one-to-one exactly like a dream, right? But what what occurred to me yesterday or whatever today about Communion is that is, in its logic, very, very close to a dream. And so I don't know what that brings to the table, but I think that's an important part of it. There is a big part of Strieber's like own psyche at work in what happened there.
I mean, it's interesting because he was a horror writer, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And you wonder what effect that, because I think was he screenwriting?
Or well, he wrote the book that Hunger was based off.
The Wolfen too.
Yeah.
Because I imagine that if you're constantly creating that stuff, then your mind is primed for it when you're awake and when you're asleep, particularly if your livelihood depends on it. My opinion, and it's not a very, very educated opinion, but I think I said it to you over the weekend, Buckley, is that he is a bit of a kook. And he probably would have said a load of weird stuff even if he hadn't had an experience. But I do believe he had an experience. I don't know what the nature of that experience is, whether it was extraterrestrial, which he doesn't really claim it is, whether it's interdimensional, or whether it was like some sort of deep psychological thing. Something horrible happened to that guy. I'm pretty sure of that.
He flip-flops back and forth, though, doesn't he? Because I tried to listen to an episode of his podcast. One of the things he was saying in that was about how he was talking about the visitors, and he was like, talking about how they cured his hay fever, and he was like, really? But then within like a couple of minutes, he was talking about how horrific they were, and how, and it's like he flip-flops between, and it's that is so much like someone who's been psychologically, possibly sexually abused.
Yeah, there's trauma there for sure, you know, some kind.
What's interesting is the connection that Streber makes, and other people have been making recently as well, Joshua Kutchin, The Ecology of Souls, and those kind of books about alien encounters or encounters with these creatures and the afterlife and death and that kind of thing. Do you have any opinion, Rob, on whether there, you see a connection there or what these people might be seeing, if you don't think there is one?
Oh, yeah, I think there's a definite connection there. And there's certainly encounters that, particularly abduction encounters, that people claim to have, and, you know, have encounters with past loved ones and stuff like that. I think one of the best examples of that is David Huggins. If you get his... The book, the art book that was released like many years ago, and you go thumbing through it, you know, there are all these spectacular, you know, pieces of art that are erotic as hell, and they're fun.
Yeah, but... He's the guy with the Love and Sources documentary about him, isn't he?
One of the most... like understated pieces in the entire book is this kind of like drab off-white painting of an abduction experience in his apartment. And there's one of those mantis beings that is like standing in the corner, like they usually are with his experiences, and coming through this like portal-ish hole in the wall is David's mother, who tells him that she died, basically. So, you know, there's other stories like this, and I definitely think that there is a connection, but I don't think it's the whole thing. I think when people start to ascribe, you know, the entire thing to like one specific thing, that's where you get off, because I think it serves multiple different purposes. I think that the UFO phenomenon can serve as kind of like the psychopomp aspect of, you know, our everyday lives. And I think people who do have repeated contacts can do that. And I think in some, you know, cases, people may see UFOs and, you know, they could be signals that, hey, a loved one has died or something like that. I'm sure there's plenty of stories within the kind of annal of stories that attest to that. But, like, yeah, I think that serves one aspect of what I think UFOs are. They can certainly be that. It's just one aspect of a greater collective, I think.
When you talk about people who've had multiple experiences, have you, in your obviously quite extensive research, noticed any kind of pattern in the sorts of people who have an experience like yours, or even something far deeper, you know, abduction or whatever? Have you noticed any pattern in the sort of person it happens to?
Nope. There is no pattern. Yeah. There, it's just any and everybody that has these experiences. There's nothing that relates them in any way that I've ever really seen. They all come from different backgrounds in life and stuff like that. And like, I think one way to equate UFO sightings, it's almost like going to a tarot reader, and like you have this kind of one very interesting and fascinating tarot session that really connects with you on a deep level. And I think you can find equal equivalents in other things. Like you go, like I've done paranormal investigations and felt really connected to the spirits that were there. I've had friends who have been camping and have had giant rocks hucked at them. So, you know, maybe Bigfoot didn't want them around, but like, I think, you know, at a base level, if you really want to look at it, I think it's really about connecting to something. So whether that's other people, whether that's connecting to something higher, you know, be going on some spiritual path or something like that, it connects you to something else. It's just the UFO, the ghosts, the cryptid, they're just kind of a catalyst. And while I wouldn't necessarily call them the same thing, they all serve the same purpose, whether people want to believe that or not, specifically with cryptids, because a lot of people want to believe that they're real animals. And I don't think that they are. I just like, there are a lot of fun things that have come from, like, for instance, lumberjack folklore in the United States. Yeah, so
I love that
the
stuff.
Squonk comes from lumberjack folklore. The hodag comes from lumberjack folklore. I think my favorite is the Slide Rock Bolter, which is basically a giant land whale that hangs out at mountains that are at a 45 degree angle and then comes down and tries to eat people and has a giant claw in its tail. Like, you know, like these are all fun stories and stuff like that. But like, I also think that, you know, with whatever is behind this, it can also see that the fun stories that we have and kind of, you know, tailor itself to our time. Because if you definitely look at all of the weird stuff that has happened over the eons, it has evolved. And this is not a new theory, you know, it's valets stuff, you know, it keeps up with the times. But like, again, it just boils down to connecting people to something, whether that is other people, whether that is a higher purpose, or, you know, anything like that.
In one narrative that's being pushed quite a lot in the mainstream-ish at the moment is Psulka, secret machines, the idea of an ancient, almost religious type experience. I mean, going from sort of the sacred to the profane and so on, you know, you've got that, and then you've got the lumberjack folklore and so on. But yeah, out of the lumberjack folklore, you get the Sasquatch as well, all this stuff, which has been very enduring. Do you think that this is all the same thing being viewed through different lenses? You know, because people will, as we've kind of discussed, we've been kind of circling around it as we've had this discussion tonight, that people will kind of put their own interpretation or almost what they want to see or expect to see or need to see. They will dress their experience in those particular clothes, I suppose. How do you think that works? Like, how, because that is like high strangeness, isn't it? You know, like I always find experiences that don't have an element of high strangeness or something peculiar about them to be less believable in a way. Like Romanek stuff was very like very nuts and bolts, very you know, there was a little man outside my window and you know, that kind of thing. There was none of the craziness and the strangeness and the weirdness that you get with a lot of other experiences. How does that work? What do you think the high strangeness element is?
I think, you know, when it comes down to it, everybody looks at, you know, religious fables. And I think some people look at like these kind of encounters and experiences as confirmation of, you know, what's written in, you know, whatever holy text that you have. I'm not some like, I'll just come out and say it. People's experiences with this stuff is more believable than anything in the Bible, just because, like, if you look at the scholars that, you know, research the Bible and stuff like that, there is no historical accuracy to anything in the Bible that anybody can, you know, pinpoint. So I think some people may view that as like, well, hey, this is God showing up in whatever form. And then, you know, God, because in the Bible, God, you know, and angels take different forms, you know, and yeah. Like, I think if I'm rating them on a scale of 1 to 10, burning bush is low. It's low. Like, you know, if I was going to Yelp review that, I'd probably give it 1 star and say, can we do this any easier? I think, you know, whatever Ezekiel was dealing with, because like I'm down with angels with 4 different heads and wings and stuff like that. And, like,
yeah. A million eyes.
Yeah. Totally, you know, that. But I think when people have a religious framework that they have chose to put themselves in, it's easy to see these experiences and kind of adapt them into their particular framework. And what's the most common framework? Well, Christianity. So it's easy to see these things as either evidence of God or devils. Like, I can't tell you how many TikToks I've ever made about UFOs and somebody's like, oh, it's the devil. And it's like, yeah. Instantly delete your comment. I'm not doing this, but, you know.
But do you think that that kind of almost religious, quite kind of Catholic tinged imagery seems to be being pushed bit more heavily at the moment, mm-hmm. in terms of when you think about like the Pasolda
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, when you read Encounters, apparently Jacques Vallée says to her, Satan, you know, read about Satan.
Like, read this book about Satan and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, which
like,
is just like a TikToker commenting on your TikTok, you know, it's like Jacques Vallée commenting on Pasolda's research, you know, you should be getting into the devil here.
Yeah, and it's like, mm-hmm. what's going on there, do you think?
It's funny to look at Vallée because it's like Vallée has done a complete 180, because Vallée started out as a nuts and bolts guy, and then he goes into more of this, you know, interdimensional kind of stuff, and then he comes back with, like, Trinity and that kind of stuff. I'm not the biggest fan of Pasolka's writing, mostly because, one, it feels very classist, because most of the people that she's talking about are like rich as fucking hell, and like that's annoying in and of itself. It's like it's the same narrative of like military encounters dominating American UFO like culture right now. There's
it's
more.
It's not
to
the experience of the common man, is it, or the common person?
Right. Yeah. I don't care about the experiences of rich people because I'm not a rich person, and I just. And again, it comes down to capitalism. Fuck capitalism. That's the best, best way I can put it. It's just like. One thing that I've always said about this phenomenon to other people is that you do not need to come into people don't have to have a structured belief system in order to experience this stuff. It just happens. So when people start taking structured beliefs that they already had and try to kind of fit them together, I can't stand that. I haven't read Bledsoe's book. I don't know if I can bring myself to do it. I've contemplated doing the audiobook because, like, if I'm going to listen to it and I'm going to be pissed off, I want to be pissed off at work because I think I can make that work for me. And like,
at least you're getting paid to be pissed off.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's exactly. Capitalism for you.
I can take my frustration out in folding a piece of laundry. And, you know, it's just that I think that aspect is kind of, it's been there in one way or the other. Like, it's always kind of hanging out in the back and like nobody wants to bring it up. And every time somebody tries to bring it up, it's like, you know, hush, hush. And I mean, like, I, cause I know you frame this in, you know, the work of Pasolka, Peter Lavenda, who I cannot stand him either. I'm not the biggest fan of Peter Lavenda and his crazy crap. It's like the dude's obsessed with H.P. Lovecraft. Like, get over it, man. Just get the fuck over it. Like, another controversial hot take. Cthulhu sucks. I hate Cthulhu. Cthulhu is a little bitch, okay? Cthulhu got hit with a boat and it decided, oh, I got hit in the leg. I'm going to go back down into the deeps again.
Don't listen, Cthulhu. He doesn't mean it.
Exactly. But it's just like, it just seems like the most ridiculous lens to view this all through. Because when viewing some, like, greater consciousness, why is the, like, one of the things that you're bringing up is, do you believe that Jesus died on the cross? You, alien man, did he die on the cross? And it's always interesting with some of the answers that you get in certain, like, abduction accounts who say that, oh, we're confirmation of God and stuff like that. And, like, I always find that to be kind of hilarious and interesting, especially if you take it from like the 1980s abduction perspective of Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs, who say the aliens are lying to you. So
yeah,
the thing is that when you talk about that bit, the religious aspect being kind of a bit of a ridiculous lens to view it through, but that is, it doesn't necessarily, if that's being pushed at the moment, mm-hmm. that doesn't necessarily mean the people pushing it believe it. You know, if you see what I mean, like it's almost like, because it's coming to the fore at the moment, it's almost like, why is it coming to the fore? I guess is what I'm interested
in. I think Pasulka believes it. It's my take on it.
Definitely.
Yeah. Certainly Pasulka, I feel, and obviously I know nothing about it other than reading her books and a little bit of what I found doing a little bit of digging, but I just feel like she's being pushed in and pulled in certain directions. I mean, I enjoyed both her books, and like I enjoyed Lavenda, but I see the, you know, like the ridiculousness of it all. I feel like, and I hate to say it because it's a cliche, but like, I feel like you can't really trust anyone. Everyone's got an agenda, everyone's opinion, even if don't know they've got an agenda, they've been pushed into it.
I straight up came on at this podcast and I have an agenda. It's called fuck capitalism. I mean, it's been my whole MO since.
You're in the right place again there, Robert.
Yeah, I mean, with Lavenda, it's like, I'm a fan of his work. I do love the Sinister Forces books. I've just finished reading them and I think they're great. And with the Secret Machine stuff, I enjoyed them, but it did feel a bit like kind of Lavenda light almost. Mm-hmm. And it just, but you just wonder, I guess with Lavenda is an interesting one because I can't work out whether he's a manipulator or being manipulated.
Yeah, the one that interests me the most, and I don't know if you've got a take on it, Rob, is we were just talking about Jacques Vallée. Mm. And he seems more and more, the more I read more widely about weird stuff, he's always lurking in the background, like the cigarette smoking man from the X-Files. You know,
he is the cigarette smoking man. Yeah, he is.
Yeah, you go to like the Stanford Institute when they were doing the remote viewing, and who's there but Jacques Vallée? You know, you go to the creation of the internet, and who's there? It's Jacques Vallée. You know, it's like, and then you've got this Pasulka stuff. Who's there with their book about Satan?
And who's a venture capitalist?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
There you go.
Again, capitalism. Capitalism, people.
Because I used to think that he was this like paragon of like some sort of wisdom and virtue within when I first started reading, when you read Passport to Magonia, and it's very like 1960s and wide-eyed again, you know, curious. But now, looking at him from probably what's going to probably be towards the end of his career, I'm wondering how much of a player and a manipulator he is himself.
Yeah, I've had conversations with people because I don't understand how the man has the clearances that he does. I know that he initially wanted to build a computer database for Project Blue Book, but they denied him. But he still is in certain areas in the government, and I don't know how, other than, all of this computer science stuff, his, you know, venture capitalism and such, which, you know, kind of funds all of his stuff. I think when it comes to Valet, I think the most valuable resources that we have on him are his journals, which is great that he's published them all, in five volumes so far. I don't know if there's really anything else that I want to read about the man. But like when you get into volume 3, which is about the 1980s, that's when things start to get really interesting, because with modern ufology and what people are interested in this, you know, government disclosure stuff, that's all basically in the form that it is now. It started in the 80s in the way that, you know, you can look to Doty, but I think it goes deeper than Doty. I think Doty, to a certain extent, like there's always that question of how much of it is Doty and how much of it is Doty's superiors kind of pushing the stuff. But when you look at UFO crash narratives and when they start to emerge, like, in the late 40s, early 50s, the Roswell narrative didn't make it that far. When it was first published in the papers, like you got some West Coast papers that ran with that story for a little bit before they printed that retraction, and maybe a tiny smattering of East Coast, and there were some radio reports. That's it. And then you get Frank Scully coming on the scene with this Aztec New Mexico thing that, you know, turns out to be a hoax from Silas Newton and stuff. And Behind the Flying Saucers becomes this like joke. And then they begin to emerge again in 1978. There's two very important events that happened in 1978. The first is that Stanton Friedman is doing a radio interview in Louisiana, and the interviewer says, "Hey, you should talk to this Jesse Marcel guy, because he, you know, talks about, you know, crashed UFOs and stuff like having recovered something." The second thing is that at the annual MUFON conference, Leonard Stringfield delivers this presentation. And he delivers like six of these over his the remainder of his career, remainder of his life. And they are these crash retrieval status updates. And in the first one, he just like starts throwing a bunch of, names, well, not necessarily names, because like everything's like hidden source, but he starts throwing out all these UFO crashes that the government has been involved in recovering and stuff. And we're talking like, I want to say there's like close to 20 in the first one. These were all printed in UFO journals, and he goes on to give like a lot more of these status updates and future conferences and publishes them and stuff like that. And then from there, you got Stanton Friedman, who really just like hammers that Roswell thing. You know, he gets Bill Moore involved, and, you know, Bill Moore publishes the Roswell incident. The main reason that Roswell became a household like event that everybody knew is because it was featured on Unsolved Mysteries. Like that's literally the connecting point, because, you know, at that time there's a lot more of that weird paranormal programming that are starting to emerge, sightings and stuff like that. And it's like one of the highest rated segments in Unsolved Mysteries history. And it does so well that they air it again and they draw even higher ratings after that. So the 1980s is very interesting. And when you read Valet's kind of journals, his journal from that period of time, there's a lot of very interesting stuff. Like he talks about like how with SRI, he's like, oh, people don't know the extent to which, you know, people were doing that stuff. And like, you know, I think one of the interesting kind of like wild cards in all of this and how he always gets connected is Uri Geller, and how everybody just seems to believe every little thing. It's like, I witnessed this in his presence, and, you know, this happened and stuff like that. And it's like, the spoon bending stuff is not nearly as compelling as y'all make it out to be. You know? So, but like, I mean, Uri Geller is an interesting figure, as is Andrea Puharich, you know, guiding him the entire way. But especially, you know, when Valet writes about him and stuff like that, because in Valet's books in particular, I think it's The Invisible College, like, he's pretty much believes Uri Geller in most of what he has to offer.
But I mean, the interesting thing, I know we've been joking about it a lot tonight, but like, the 1980s was also the rise of like neoliberalist capitalism. You know, you have, I mean, Thatcher in 1979, wasn't it? You had Reagan in America, and the refocus on the individual and the individual experience, you know, the kind of almost like a loss of community values, you know, and that seems to mirror what was happening in terms of these like odd experience that people were having, where they were believing that a being was coming from light years and light years away just to tell them something, or just to pluck them out of their bed at night to do something to them. You know, and obviously in the background to that as well, you have the military industrial complex, you know, like going into overdrive. By the end of the 80s, you have the first Gulf War and so on, and it's continued sort of, you know, ever since. It's just, it all seems to be an interesting milieu for all of that to be happening at the same time.
And plus, you've got at the tail end of the 70s, going into the early 80s, you've got Close Encounters and you've got E.T. And, you know, there is a school of thought, isn't there, that Close Encounters is, that some of the Spielberg films are kind of manipulative in terms of, you know, kind of pushing a certain agenda as far as aliens and UFOs go. And then you've got to look at, you know, sort of Valet was a consultant in Close Encounters.
Valet, I mean, Hynek, they were both consultants on that film, and I think what's interesting is, like, you know, there are certain cases that he brought to the table when they wanted to do that, but like, if you look at Close Encounters of the Third Kind and you look at like a lot of the other sci-fi films, you know, before that, so like Alien Contact was not portrayed all that particularly well. I think, you know, probably the most benevolent, you know, before that was The Day the Earth Stood Still, and even then, that, you know, it gets violent at times. Like, we can't not look at aliens through that violent lens. Like, we have to, because well, we're a very violent species at times, so like it's hard not to. And like, I think the one thing that doesn't get talked about enough in like the 80s is the series V, because like V is the truth behind it all. I swear to, no, I'm just kidding. But it's a great series anyway. And I'm sure David Icke loved it. He actually absolutely owns multiple copies of it. But that 80s, what happened in the 80s with everything from Bob Lazar to MJ-12 to Roswell, alien abductions, it all gets packaged into the 90s into things like the X-Files and other similar things. So it becomes,
because they were drawing on.
Yeah. They were drawn on all that. So it becomes, that becomes the pop culture view of this. So in essence, it changes from, you know, this kind of more nuanced. And what has always drawn me to this subject is how nuanced it is. How strange in that nuance that it is, and despite the fact that people want to have a particular view of it, that's not exactly how things happen. That's not exactly how these encounters take place, or how they, you know, how these play out for people. They're very different, very varied in themselves, and they don't, you know, align to a rhetoric of, you know, government disinformation and government control and stuff like that. All when it all starts being about the government and less about the aliens, it really makes you wonder, well, why is that interesting? Why do we even care? What makes us even think that the government knows what? Because Bob Lazar said he worked on a sport model for 2 weeks. What is a guy going to learn about a UFO in 2 weeks? Come on. Like, no, that is the sketchiest thing. Like, one of the sketchiest things about Bob Lazar.
There's a lot of
sketchy things. Oh, there is. But I'm like, I figured out a UFO in 2 weeks. No, you didn't. Stop it.
When we're talking about this idea that you have about the Earth giving messages to people and changing the course of their life, that is like a dark reflection of this manipulation, you know, the Mirage Men sort of thing, which is using the same principle, but it's humans doing it to other humans, you know, your dotes and whatnot. It just shows kind of the power of that, of an idea, you know, that it can be manipulated in that way. But, and this thing that we have at the moment that's just constant, and I want to kind of get your take on what you think this disclosure thing is, because I've just said it and thought about it and talked about it so much now that it's kind of lost meaning completely. I mean,
that's maybe the point.
Well, yeah, I mean, what is it? What is going to be disclosed? I just don't get it. Is it that people think that there is something to be disclosed, or is it just like the idea of paradise, you know, it's just constantly a little bit further away, you know, you've just got to keep on trying your best and eventually you're going to get there. You know, you've got to keep the faith. You got to keep on hoping, praying and so on. What's your take on that whole thing?
I think disclosure is just another way in which people make money. Different people come forward and try to make money off of pinning the government with UFOs, dead alien bodies, and you know, even less harsh, like video footage, which I'm not wowed by that video footage. You know, there's like that one video where the UFO is like shifting throughout the air and stuff, and it's like, ooh, it's rotating. I've rotated on ice, people, and fallen on my ass. That's not any more spectacular than that video. Like, you know, Mick West has always had interesting, you know, an analyses of that, which I trust. I think Mick goes a little too far sometimes, and like, he becomes very annoying, for lack of a better term. But like, I respect the skeptical people doing things. My issue with the skeptics usually comes, and it's not really always the skeptics. It's the debunkers who just like do a really bad job of, you know, poorly explaining something and like trying to make a theory fit into the event, which doesn't work. Like any of the,
start with the conclusion.
Yeah. Like any, like, you know, the CSI folks do that all the time. And like, it's boring. It's lazy science because they're trying to do this under the label of science. For one, I don't think this phenomenon is explainable by science because you can't replicate it for one. You can't. There have been moments in which, you know, there have been a phenomenon that, you know, people compare to UFOs and say that it, you know, it's replicable, you know, whether that's the Hesselin lights or, you know, like the Brown Mountain lights or something like that. And even then, it's not totally, you can't totally replicate it. It's not really possible. But I think disclosure is kind of like, is on the same level of like vaccine misinformation. It's people in a certain situation who don't feel, how do I put this, smart enough in a situation, or want to feel like they can get their information from someplace else and, you know, do your own research. And yeah. Like it gives them, it empowers people who don't have the answers and
can't be bothered looking for them.
Yeah, it empowers idiots, for lack of a better term. It's good at empowering idiots.
I mean, it works similar to like your sort of Jordan Peterson type people, or like your David Icke's, even, you know, just like that kind of guru figure that sort of a certain type will gravitate towards because it feels like this person is offering an alternative to whatever oppressive system is in place that's making my life hell. And we all know what oppressive system that is.
Oh yeah,
don't we, Rob? Capitalism. Fuck
capitalism. Like Jordan Peterson is the kind of guy in the way he speaks. Like the inflection in his voice, he talks like a guy whose bully is right off camera or right off mic and is about to like beat him up, because like he just sounds like he's about to get the shit beat out of him. But I mean, like, you know,
I liked it when he just like ate beef for like a month
until he got ill
to try and prove some point about, because he's really upset about vegans for some reason, isn't he? And he was trying to prove some point about like sticking it to the libs, and you know, this'll show them. Yeah. I'll give myself scurvy and like bowel cancer or whatever. And then he got addicted to like Xanax or something, didn't he? Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It's interesting that you talk about disclosure being about money, because this is exactly it, isn't it? You know, the conditions have been laid by what happened in the 80s, both in terms of the UFO mythology, but also in terms of the capitalist system. Mm-hmm. You know, so the two have come together to make this perfect storm. I mean, how many millions is Uri Geller worth? His house was recently for sale, and you could see it on an estate agent's website. And
you can see it from fucking space. Well, yeah, I mean, on an estate agent's website.
That spoon bending is a profitable business.
Oh, you know? it absolutely was for him. It's like, are you familiar with the Stardust Ranch story? It's a ranch in Arizona, and this one guy, let me get his name, because I can never remember his name. John Edmonds. Okay, he buys this ranch in Arizona, and what I think he found is that it's a bust. It's not worth having. So he wants to sell it, and he wants to sell it for much higher than it's actually worth. So he concocts this alien these alien stories in which these aliens are coming to abduct his wife, but he's out here with a katana, you know, beheading aliens and stuff like that. And what's interesting is the property itself was assessed for $450,000. When he initially went to market, he was asking for $2.2 million for it.
Wow.
And then when nobody was biting, you know, chomping at the bit, he brought it down to $1.5 million because he knows it's just a useless piece of property and nobody wants to buy it. Like, there's that piece of audio. Like, if anybody's ever listened to The Saucer Life, which is a great, great podcast about it's by Aaron Gullius, who is a history teacher who has covered the contactees and many of the contactees like through and through. And there's a piece of audio from someone, and I can't remember who it is, but they're saying UFO might as well stand for unfounded financial opportunity, which is what it is. really what it is. I mean, if you look at things like, Alien Con is huge for the History Channel and those guys. Like, they make millions doing the concert.
Yeah, Skinwalker Ranch, you know, the way that that's been like continually exploited and, you know, turned into opportunities, TV series, you know, all this crazy stuff, you know, over something which sketchy at best, you know. The whole thing, I mean, there's such a massive, and this is the problem, isn't it? You know, like, there's such a massive opportunity for grifters.
Oh, yeah.
you know, and so much of the legend and the mythos is written by the grifters.
Mm-hmm.
It obscures whatever truth or goodness or interesting legitimate phenomenon might actually be out there.
Yeah, it obscures the, you know, if we're going with Rob's theory, it obscures the message that could be coming from
the actual message.
Climate.
Again, capitalism fucking ruins everything. God damn it. I'm trying to have a deeper relationship with the earth, and here comes these motherfuckers. I swear to God.
It's the C word.
Big time. Big time, yeah. It's always about the money.
So we usually ask our guests at this point if they can recommend anything that would put them, our listeners, into their way of thinking, or that might expand on our listeners' knowledge in this particular topic. Can you recommend any books, movies, documentaries, TV shows, music, podcasts, YouTube channels that our listeners can go and check out today?
Yeah, so the books that I always recommend that people go to... you know, with Valet, people always be like, you know, Passport to Magonia and stuff like that. But his Alien Contact trilogy, which is Dimensions, Confrontations, and Revelations, are kind of the three essential books that gives you a wide view of what this topic is about. Because in the first one, he's talking about kind of his how the phenomenon connects to like fairy folklore and stuff like that. It's kind of like a rehashing of Passport to Magonia, but for a more modern take on it that includes what was going on at that particular time in the 80s, which is, you know, abductions and stuff. And he talks a little crap about, you know, David Jacobs and stuff like that. So which is great. The second book is about his personal investigations, and some of the cases featured in that are freaky as hell. Just really so damn strange that they're great. In particular, the Happy Camp California case. That's one that'll give you nightmares. It's very freaky. And then Revelations is about all the grifters and stuff. There's a great conversation that he has with Bill Cooper and stuff in there, and like just like making fun of Bill Cooper all the time. It's so great. But he touches on kind of like how the right wing aspect has always been in the phenomenon, and it kind of exploits it very easily and such. So I definitely recommend that. As for documentaries, Witness of Another World is one of the best that you'll ever see.
It's brilliant.
Because you see how these cases kind of affect people in their lives, and that particular witness, like, it was a struggle for him his entire life. And I always appreciate those kind of views of these particular stories, which was it inspired me to do episode 163, which is called The Wyoming Well and the Cult They Dug Up From It, which is the story of Pat McGuire and his son David, and how a UFO cult affected, you know, his family and stuff like that, which it's a very bleak view, but it's one that needed to be told. And as for there's a great YouTube channel called Think Anomalous, and Think Anomalous dives into all of this stuff, and they cover a lot of different topics, a lot of it UFO related, but The animations that they do are absolutely fantastic, but they cover like this esoteric kind of view of UFOs. So I would say those will really, you know, set you on the path of like really getting into this topic and seeing how nuanced and how deep it can actually go and how weird it can actually get.
Is it true that you're writing a book?
Yeah, it's a slow process, but it's something that I've always wanted to do because I feel that I have a very interesting view of, in particular, the humanoid phenomenon, because I don't think it's one that has a lot of nuance in most of the books that are published about it, because most of them seem to be like, here's a list of cases and such that don't get into a lot of depth on them. Although, you know, there are some good books out there. Patrick Huey's Extraterrestrial Field Guides is a fun book that has, like, you know, little blurbs about everything like that. But one thing that I've always wanted to do is really dive into that history and like put it into one place. So that's what I'm working on. It's going to take a long time to do it, but one of the things that I've decided is that because if you've listened to the last episode of Our Strange Skies, at the time and in my headspace, I was like, do I even want to really do this anymore? I ultimately came to the conclusion that I do, and I can use researching for the podcast to actually help me with the book. So it's kind of bridging both, bridging that gap right there and really using one to help with the other. And there are other projects that I'm interested in doing. I think there's a short story collection that's kind of going around in my head that I'd like to do at some point. But it's probably going to take a couple of years. But I'm writing a book, and with Welcome UFO People, we are getting close to the amount of comics that we have to actually put into a book. So we're like, I think, two away, and we're gonna put some extras in it. We've got some friends of ours who are gonna do some like variant artwork to include in it, and we have someone tapped to write an intro for it, a good friend of mine. So that in and of itself, at least in terms of books, will be coming out sometime later this year.
Excellent. Looking forward to all of that. Brilliant. And
yeah, sounds good.
If people want to find you online, where can they find you?
If you're crazy enough to want to know what I'm doing and such, you can follow me on Twitter at your UFO guy, spelled Y-E-R UFO guy. You can also follow at Our Strange Skies. I post updates there. And you can follow those accounts also on Instagram as well. I usually post stuff over there. So if that's if you're interested in that UFO stuff and how much capitalism sucks, you know, just pop on over.
I would recommend that everyone does that immediately. And if anyone wants to listen to more Vase or find more Vase, you can find us at Twitter or Instagram, and that's at Vase, and then Vase spelled backwards. So that's at VaySeeSyav. You can get our website at www.vase.co.uk. Our podcast is available on all the major platforms, but it's only on the website that you get the full show notes, so check those out. If you want to email us with your own experiences or comments, then you can do so at vaseinfo@gmail.com. Bandcamp has the soundtrack, and just today, the excellent Volume 2 of the soundtrack has dropped. You can find that on Bandcamp. The link is on our website, and I would recommend everyone goes and has a listen to that. You will have heard little bits of it throughout this episode. Full tracks are all there on Bandcamp at the moment. And that was all the work of Mr. Stephen Unknown Buckley. here. And if you have any spare cash that you want to throw our way, we do have a Ko-fi. And if you give us a regular subscription, you can join our Discord, which is just a really great place to be. There's loads of interesting people saying interesting things and doing interesting things. And there's a real good sense of community on there at the moment, which I'm just really enjoying. Like every day I am absolutely like inspired to kind of go on and see what people are doing and see what people are saying. So yeah, I'd recommend the base Discord.
So before you go, Rob, I wondered who would win in a fight between Jacques Vallée and capitalism.
Oh man.
I tried to think, I was going to say Cthulhu, but then I thought, no, let's go one further.
One further in the horrifying cosmic terror, and you get to capitalism. But that this is interesting because if you look at Jacques Vallée as either the cigarette smoking man or the devil, then is it the devil is fighting capitalism?
Right. That's the thing is like, I think right now, they're, you know, buddy-buddy. They're kind of like, you know, mingling. But if the balance of power separates, I think capitalism will beat down that old man. I just think that's how it's going to happen.
How old is capitalism? Is it older than Jacques
Vallée? Oh, yeah. It's older than Jacques Vallée. You know, it's been around
quite a while. At what point are we counting the beginning of capitalism?
I mean, like, should we say the Industrial Revolution? I mean,
well, no, I would say when the word came about. Because if you think about it, it's like a mimetic thing.
You know, I think when Adam Smith was writing dumb words in a book or something like that, I think that's about when you can pin it down. Because like, if there's any, there are a few figures in history that I would absolutely love to punch in the face. You know, everybody's going to go for Hitler and stuff. And, I totally accept that. I'd like to punch Adam Smith right in the face and just say, I hate him.